Hello, and welcome to Matters of Chat, a weekly political discussion podcast with me, Murray.
And me, Alex.
And we're two investigative journalism MA students at City University, but we're more than that. We are people that like to talk about things, so we've decided to self-indulge ourselves in this podcast where we're going to discuss politics, but it's not just going to be who's going to be the next US president, who's going to be the next Labour leader. We're going to take a deep dive into the big issues surrounding policy and things that truly affect people.
Indeed.
So, okay, first, before we start, Alex, tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, so my name's Alex. I am an MA student in investigative journalism at City. I have lived in the glorious metropolis of Watford my whole life.
Very nice. Are you near the junction?
No, I'm sadly a little away.
You're not
away.
Even in the best bit then.
Exactly. Well,
are you near,
debatable.
Are you near Vicarage Road?
Maybe that should be a debate topic. My parents' first house was there, so I lived there for 3 years in my early stages.
So you're a raging Watford fan?
Yes, of course. Know everything about them.
Okay, good. And the big question that is on everyone's lips, how are you going to celebrate Brexit Day?
I'm going to celebrate Brexit Day by going for a film at the front. It's going to be nice.
What are you seeing?
Probably going to have a drink afterwards. Jojo Rabbit.
Uh-huh. Oh, hey, that's brilliant.
Hope so.
So there won't be any kind of raise a glass at 11 o'clock to mark
the occasion? Oh, you know, by that point, I'll probably be boogieing the night away. I don't know. Okay. Why one glass when you can have 10? And yeah, how about you, Murray?
Well,
tell me about yourself.
I'm also on this course, and prior to that, I lived in Vietnam for 2 years, which was fun. Very fun. Not very productive, but very fun. But I learned a lot. I guess I've got a more global perspective now.
That's why he's going to
be. No, the best thing I learned really was, sadly, not Vietnamese language. But how to ride, drive a motorbike. So
nice.
That was good. And I, in terms of journalism, I worked for 1 year on the historic paper that was the Times of Tunbridge Wells. Mm. So if anyone knows Royal Tunbridge Wells or the town of Tunbridge in Kent, and ever picked up the free newspaper that stands soggy outside the train station, then you might have read my prose from once in a while.
Oh, I'm sure it's only poetry from you.
About train ticket prices or garden centres, that general kind of topic.
The real meat of the paper.
Yes. But on Brexit Day, I'm heading down to Parliament Square. I want to see who is out there celebrating.
Enjoying
I'm not
going to
be
light
celebrating
show.
Myself. I'm going there as a,
of course not.
A neutral force. But I'm going to take my dictaphone and interview people there, see why they're there and see how they're feeling about it. And maybe write up a piece. I'll report back. I'll report back next week to give my impressions.
My parents the other day suggested at supper that we all wear black for Friday. it took me a moment before I realised that they were serious.
Wow. So they're really devastated.
They've been radicalised. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
If they were on Twitter, they'd be hashtag FBPE all the way.
Okay. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm a bit over Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk about more interesting issues on this podcast. First up this week, what are we talking about?
Huawei. I'm told that's pronounced.
Yes, that's with an H. The mobile phone telecoms provider.
Okay.
And the controversial decision to bring them into the UK's 5G network.
Indeed.
And then we're going to talk about some of the lesser-known stories from around the world
mm-hmm.
that we think are important, but maybe haven't got the coverage they deserve. And then lastly, we're going to have a debate about...
open borders.
Yes. Alex is saying, let them all in. Let them roam free. In, out, shake it all about. Whereas mm-hmm. I'm on the more cautious approach.
Hardcore nativist.
Yes.
Murray over here.
Yeah, now we randomly assign these sides, so these aren't our real views, but we're just making the best arguments we could think of for each side. Okay, so let's jump into Huawei.
Woo!
Woo!
So, yes, this week saw the historic announcement by Boris Johnson that he would allow Huawei a place in the UK's 5G infrastructure network. Mm-hmm. Huawei is a telecoms giant based in China, founded in 1987. And this is a very big deal because Huawei is the only company capable of providing 5G technology right now at present to the standard the UK wants it to. But the US suspects that because it is fully state-owned by the Chinese government, that Huawei is sneaking spyware into its technology. So that by installing Huawei technology in the UK on a mass scale, the UK will be opening itself up to massive vulnerabilities to Chinese spies.
Yeah, and it's definitely the vulnerability. It's not necessarily that people believe there's going to be spies right now.
Yeah.
It's that because Huawei is a Chinese company, by law, by Chinese law, they essentially have to do what the Chinese government tell them.
Yes.
So at any point in the future, whoever is ruling China could demand this of Huawei, and there's nothing they could really do to resist that demand.
Yeah. So the worry is that there would be security backdoors built in now that wouldn't necessarily be used now, but could be used at any point by the Chinese government.
So let's talk about the political context for the decision. Boris Johnson was under a lot of pressure from people not to do this, as was Theresa May before. Theresa May kind of delayed the decision, but it's on Bojo's desk. Well, I guess one, why is 5G important, would you say, Alex?
It makes our phones faster.
That's very important.
Quite a lot faster.
That is what the people want.
Indeed, yes. I mean, this is extremely important because as the world progresses, the idea is that more and more of our gadgets will start using the internet. So it won't just be our phones, it won't just be our computers, it will also be our fridges, our ovens, all sorts of things. And the idea is that these things will all be interacting and collecting data and making our lives faster and easier in a multitude of ways. So this is going to have huge implications for productivity as the world moves forward, which is going to make the world a better place, hopefully.
Yeah. So it's a huge infrastructure product.
Yes.
Project. It's going to help a lot of people. It's going to make life more convenient, productivity, as you say.
It's also going to screw over our weather forecasting.
Oh, really?
Yes. It uses the same 5G in general, not just Huawei. 5G in general uses the same frequencies as weather satellites, I think. So it's going to make our weather forecast less accurate. So it's a bit of a trade-off whether you want your fridge to be connected to the internet or an accurate weather forecast.
I know what people over 60 would say to that.
Not good things.
Yeah. No. My parents love a weather chat.
Exactly.
They're less concerned about 5G.
Good to know how old your parents are.
But the reason Boris Johnson have done this, right, because it's not like he doesn't care about security of the UK's, internet network.
Probably not.
He's made this decision.
Always possible.
Based on economics, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, so the Huawei has by far the most advanced 5G technology. There are lots of US firms and British firms that are also developing 5G technology, but none of them are quite at the same level as Huawei is. So and the UK wants to start developing its 5G network now. Otherwise, it would have to be a long wait. So by making this decision, we are heralding our cyber future far more quickly than we would otherwise be. So yes, it's going to be good for our economy. And also, there is some degree of doubt, as I understand it, whether this is really as much of a security issue as the US is making it out to be. In that, on the one hand, the US says this is a major security issue. We will be unable to share US intelligence with the UK if you allow Huawei into your networks. Keep Huawei out, or we can't have any relations with you, UK. But on the other hand, Trump has notoriously said that sanctions on Huawei are open for negotiations, part of the broader trade war. So it is a question of, you know, sometimes the US is saying, let's say, cut and dry security issue, and sometimes it's saying that it is a trade dispute, which is a very different thing. Johnson may have decided that the US protestations about this are not entirely truthful, is also a possibility. Because MI6 and MI5 have concluded, apparently, that the security risk from Huawei technology being incorporated into the UK network is manageable.
Yes, manageable is the key word. I guess some of the arguments from... So the most vocal MP against this is Tom Tugendhat, who is...
Your guy.
Yes, MP for Tunbridge and Morling, back when I was down at the local paper there. He's also the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. He's big on foreign affairs and security.
Newly re-elected.
Yes. Congratulations.
if you're listening. I'm sure you are.
but he's been very much saying, you know, you're letting the fox amongst the chickens, and, you know, a manageable risk is only manageable now. Why are we accepting a risk that, while it's quotes, is manageable? Why are we having that risk at all? And, you know, technology changes quickly. Mm. It's not, while it may be fine now, it might be harder to protect further down the line.
At the same time, though, I mean, the Chinese are going to spy on us whatever we do.
Well, we shouldn't make it easier for them.
Of course we shouldn't. No.
Shouldn't invite them in.
Okay, but every country maintains a list. You know, there's a kind of mutual knowledge that there are going to be spies from our country in other countries, and there are going to be spies from other countries in this country, and they're always going to be able to know a certain amount of information. And there's not much you can really do about that unless you want to... You know,
but that's the whole
construct an iron curtain.
The whole 5G network is an unprecedented network, right? Of the internet of all things. It's potentially sort of all of the UK's data roaming around our country, allowing access to that, right? No spy in the world has ever have been able to access that. So the idea of inviting them in to sort of have their ear to the ground already on this flow of data is... It seems risky.
So we should be clear that Johnson is not inviting them in everywhere.
No,
there was a 35% cap on market share that Huawei will not be able to exceed.
And it was in non-core areas.
Yes, so they will not be allowed near nuclear sites or military sites.
And not where data is processed.
Yes. But the whole 35% market cap thing, again, sort of makes it sound more like a trade issue than a security issue. Right?
Mm.
You know, that's a sort of, we don't want them crowding out the British competition too much. We're going to let space for British firms to grow and bloom.
And also the idea of not allowing them near nuclear sites and military bases.
Mm.
So you're sort of accepting that they will try and spy, but they won't try and spy in the 35% we've given them.
I'm just sceptical that we're going to be able to keep the Chinese out. There's already Huawei
4G
technology
everywhere. There's no point trying.
Well, I mean, better to know what they're doing and keep an eye on it. And, you know, again, like, manage the risk rather than... Yeah, it just seems a bit futile, in a way. The US intelligence community concluded that the Chinese had hacked into US electrical infrastructure much as the Russians did in 2016. The only reason it didn't make the news so much was because they didn't do anything about it with it. They just sort of sat and watched rather than... actively interfere.
Interesting.
Yeah. Although the Russians didn't actually interfere with the election infrastructure either. They just had loads of Twitter bots instead.
So on a wider issue, it's quite interesting that we're in this position where we need a Chinese company to make our infrastructure. Why do you think that might be the case?
Seems like the Chinese model of industrial strategy has worked. In this small sector, anyway. Huawei has had a huge amount of investment from the Chinese Development Bank, whereas the Western model, we have multiple telecoms companies all competing with each other, meaning that they're all small, piddling little fish in the sea compared to the great larger fish of Huawei.
Yeah. It was said that the only other viable options were Nokia, I think.
Mm.
And I haven't had
you
one.
You dissing
of,
Nokia?
I haven't had one of them. seen one of them since about 2007. So
I'm amazed they're still around.
Yeah. So yes, it does present a new, as we enter a new decade, a new sort of frontier of trade war, a technology war, wars that China does appear to be stripping ahead.
Yes.
So I
don't know how much of an impact do you think this will really have on US-UK foreign relations? Because that's really the context in which we need to see it, isn't it? In that, Brave New World on Friday, leaving the European Union, we're going to be on our own. So we can't stick with, we could stick with Europe's foreign policy and everything as we have historically been doing. But also, Europe was disunited even when we were part of its union in terms of foreign policy. So the question is, do we go full Trump in terms of our foreign policy, or do we maintain a more sceptical stance and try to cozy up to China at the same time as well? And with this compromised position, that's what Johnson seems to be trying to do.
Yeah, true. I think it will become impossible to cozy up to China if we're looking to get a US trade deal, really. I think they'll put their foot down if there was any more movement to cozy up to China, that is. But it has surprised me how, on a couple of things, Huawei and the foreign diplomat or the diplomat's wife that fled after seemingly killing that 19-year-old in a car accident. I think Harry Dunn. I think
and was the
you know they
name.
Said an extradition request was put in by the UK government, which was angered the US foreign department because they said it was completely inappropriate. So like on these couple of things, it's shown. They're not necessarily scared about standing up to the US that we traditionally see. But then on other things, Johnson's praised Trump's Middle East deal, and he's, backed the killing in Iran, essentially, or sort of said, I haven't really got a problem with it.
It's a funny one with Trump, because I get the impression that his relations with the US at the moment depend on how much Trump likes the other head of state on a personal level, rather than actual policy differences, because everybody was sort of saying with the Kim Darroch cables leaks, everybody said, this is going to hugely damage US-UK relations. And it didn't,
Darroch left his job,
like, it's fine, Like, it's not great, but it's fine.
Yeah.
And similarly with this, the amount of... This has been an issue going on for years, and the amount of US lobbying beforehand was huge. But it's like, Mike Pompeo just, I can't remember if it was earlier this morning or the other day, but, was saying it's fine, like, they're not happy, but they're not going to cut us off or sanction us or anything.
Yeah, exactly. I think maybe there's a case...
It doesn't suit Trump from a domestic US policy standpoint to pick a major fight with the UK, I don't think, because his base is kind of likes the UK.
Yeah, and it actually seemed like it was a lot of bluster from the US over this, expecting us to bow down to
their
threat. And the fact that we haven't, maybe they feel a bit chastened, but maybe they're sort of like, okay, well, they've been pushed back a little bit, actually, and then realise that they can't dictate policy with their allies. Okay, and now on to the lesser covered stories of the week from around the world. But they can include the UK as well, if we wish.
Around the world and around the UK. Anywhere but here.
But we are starting in a more far-flung place than Westminster. We are going to Peru. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Peru. Now, Peru had some elections at the end of last year, which didn't produce a clear winner. But and some votes are still being counted. I read today, so it's quite a slow count in Peru, to be fair.
Slow and steady.
But, as long as they get it right. But,
Is that a reason for suspicion? Does it usually happen faster, or...?
No one suggested that in the reading I did.
I'm suggesting it right now. Stunning the Peru counting conspiracy.
You heard it here first.
Have you ever heard the rubber conspiracy theory about UK elections?
No.
They always provide you with pencils in the voting booth. Some people like to conspiracize that there's a massive army of civil servants rubbing the marks out.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yep, exactly.
But back to Peru.
Anyway, that's not true. I'm not spreading fake news.
Sounds like
to my knowledge. Anyway.
Also, vaccines don't work. But but Peru. So what's happened? Two things have happened in this week that are very interesting. So, firstly, the head of Peru's opposition was re-arrested this week. She'd previously been serving, she'd served about 13 months and was let out in November last year. This was all based on some corruption charges. Mm-hmm. She was let out, they had their election, and then with the new government formed, she's now been re-arrested for this, facing this ongoing trial. So
to be clear, she wasn't let out because the election was coming up, I don't think.
It doesn't appear that was the case. Yeah. But so this was part of a large scandal into money paid by a Brazilian construction firm called Odebrecht. And this
well
is... but in South America, they've spread themselves wide. That's happened. There's been, I think, about more than 10 countries where public officials have been paid money by this company.
Is that the... same scandal as the car wash scandal or another Brazilian
corruption
scandal?
No, I think it's a different one.
Wow. Well, I need one.
she's been rearrested. There's been a huge backlash against corruption over the last 10, 20 years in Peru. Peruvian voters feel that, you know, all the main parties are tainted by corruption, so there's very little trust. And interestingly, a new party formed and was quite successful in Peru's recent elections, and that was the Party of the Israelites, of the new Universal Pact. So the Agricultural People's Front of Peru, known as FREPAP, and they are religious fundamentalists. And they kind of they dress like people did in primary school nativities, of like long tea towel kind of style clothing, very plain, and they're very care about moral issues a lot. But there was a big trust in them because the one people that they voters didn't think would be tempted by economic corruption is sort of these pious religious people. But they have
like Game of Thrones.
Yeah. But they have very. They've already got in hot water for one of their head spokesmen making comments about the immorality of gay people, and you can recover your sins by turning to God and all those kind of things.
Good to hear.
And that's within the first month. One fact I did read that amazed me. Yeah. Right. So they won the second largest.
Boring up to now.
They won the second largest share of the vote. These Israelites party.
Yeah.
The second largest share at 8.9%.
Wow.
Now, I didn't look this up because, again, this is a shallow dive, but how many parties are there in Peru where the second largest one gets under 9%? I'm interested to look further into that. So, yeah, that's what's going down in Peru. So, interesting one to watch for politics.
Very nice.
Fans out there. Okay, Alex, over to you. Tell me about something.
Second shallow dive of the week is Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, who has finally been indicted on corruption charges. And this has been going on for years now. There have been rumours that Netanyahu was going to be indicted for a while. There were ongoing investigations. And then I think it was in the summer or maybe the late spring, the Israeli Attorney General announced that he would be bringing charges against Netanyahu, which started a long campaign by Netanyahu to try and get the Israeli Knesset, or parliament, to pass a law that would give him immunity from prosecution. And they would not. And he called an election and they still would not. And there have been several elections now.
There's another one in March coming up, right?
I lose count.
Yeah.
Basically because the hardline religious parties will no longer back Netanyahu because they want him to be even more right-wing. Anyway, yes, so he cannot form he keeps on failing to form a majority. So he has finally withdrawn his request to Parliament to grant him immunity from prosecution. So he has now been indicted formally. So there are several charges against him, most of which, they're all related to corruption and abuse of power. So there was a charge that he was making regulatory decisions that would benefit a big political donor of his. And there were charges that he was making decisions. So he was asking for favorable coverage from a big Israeli newspaper, and in return he was promising that he would make the decisions that would reduce the circulation of another Israeli newspaper.
Okay, very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, down to brass tacks, is this going to be the end of Netanyahu? Will he be arrested on this? Like, which way do you see it going?
Well, he has been indicted, yeah. So he will be, he will go to court and defend himself. Apparently, I read in an article in the Israeli Times, he was apparently torn about the decisions to whether to formally withdraw his request to get immunity. Because on the one hand, he protests his innocence and wishes to defend himself in court. And he was worried that getting immunity would undermine that argument because it would make him look scared.
Mm. But it would also stop him going to prison.
It would indeed. Which is always nice.
Is there any chance of if he won the election that he could impose immunity on himself in any way?
He would still have to get that passed through parliament, as far as I understand it. And I think at this point, he's kind of given up on that. Which is good for Israeli democracy, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, and our last shallow dive. We're going a bit close to the UK. Over to Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Belgium have a monarchy. That may not be news to you, but I bet you've never thought about them in the slightest, have you? Well, someone...
Insulting.
Someone who has been thinking about the Belgian monarchy.
As I do. All the time.
is a lady called Delphine Boel. I've probably not pronounced that correctly. Now, she is a 51-year-old woman who has been contesting for over a decade now that the former Belgian king, King Albert II, was her father. King Albert, he has three children already, but denied... vigorously that this woman was his fourth child, and he had immunity from this. So she launched a legal challenge to prove it, right? So you demand a DNA test and all those kind of things. He had immunity when he was in the royal family. Mm-hmm. All of these rich, powerful men getting immunity. Mm-hmm. But he abdicated the throne in 2013, and he's been fighting in the courts again and again, and it was finally ruled last year that he'd be fined more than, I think, it was around £4,000 equivalent to every day that he refused to give the DNA test. So he finally gave in, even though he receives about...
I mean, if you're a king, I mean.
Yeah. Before he...
Though he abdicated.
He gets about £1 million a year anyway, but you know.
From the state?
Yeah.
Even though he's abdicated?
Yeah, because it's his brother replaced him. But, you know, he's part of the family. But anyway.
Family affair.
To cut to the chase. Guess what? The DNA test proved that he was the father of this woman. And so she's sort of now got a bit of her identity back. She's, you know, been fighting this for a long time. And he's shown up to be the kind of a horrible, curmudgeonly bastard that he is.
So how's the Belgian press been covering this? Do they have the same... Did you not do your research into the Belgian press reaction?
I'm sure it was written about. Well,
wow.
What I do know is that this...
I'm just... Because, you know, obviously, you know, Meghan breathes and the British tabloid press gets outraged.
Yeah, well, what I do know is that what started this lady's belief that she was
banned words on this podcast.
this lady's belief that she was the king's daughter came from a book that came out in the late 90s, which suggested King Albert had an affair with a woman, and that was obviously the woman's mother, and so that was a big scandal at the time. I did read that, so I'm sure they've been covering this story in the Belgian press deeply and vigorously and forensically. But I can't say that I read any Belgian newspapers. Is that
on the other hand, I'm a great Wallonophile. Yeah.
All
I'll
right.
Forgive you this time, but next time. So you better be briefed on the Belgian
press. Well, yeah, I do apologise. I didn't read any Belgian publications in relation to this story. But that's why the show is now called
Shallow Dive.
Shallow Dive. We've changed it halfway through.
Shallow Dive?
Shallow Dive.
Just the singular.
Okay. Yeah.
Only one dive.
So that's why we've changed it halfway through the first recording. Yeah. I think that's the last chance we'll get.
Yeah.
But yeah, I hope it was informative in some little way.
Got a third segment yet to come.
Here we go. Right, and welcome to the final segment of the show where we're going to debate a contentious issue. This first week, we thought we'd do a biggie, and that is open borders. So, should there be immigration controls around the world, essentially, or should people be free to pass through borders and into different states and settle as they wish? Alex is saying yes, essentially. So, Alex, do you want to open your arguments?
Sure. Well, I mean, essentially, nation states are a construct that we don't have to abide by. They've developed only over the last few hundred years. They're fundamentally contrary to human nature. Humans have a right to roam. This world is ours. And people from other countries are no different to us. Nationality is constructed and fictitious, it only exists in our minds if we wanted to. The case for open borders lies on a number of principles. The first is economic. Economists reckon that if there are open borders and free immigration all around the world, that global economies will do far better. It will allow for free movement of people and capital. The second argument for open borders is a moral one. As I said in my opening flourish, people from India or China have no less a right to live a prosperous and happy life as we do. And essentially, a lot of the arguments against open borders that you will shortly hear from my friend in the other chair are simply erroneous and false. A lot of people will say that, yes, open borders will make economies richer as a whole, but that they will do damage to certain specific communities. I say that this is a false argument, because if we redistribute properly the gains from open borders, then we can keep that limited and keep everybody happy. The second thing that he'll say is that there's a cultural aversion to open borders, which is also a bad argument, because I'm not arguing for open borders now, I'm not arguing for open borders in 5 years. I'm saying that this is simply a utopian vision of where we should go in the long term. And I also think that we should think about where we should be as a society, not what's necessarily practical. I think we should not be afraid to make a utopian case for the ideal society where we want to be, and that cultural concerns should not put us off from that.
Okay, thanks, Alex. Well, you've made this quite easy for me. Huh? Well, yeah, so I'll begin. Well, yeah, by his own very words, it's a utopian vision. And, well, I think all sensible people know utopia doesn't exist, hasn't existed, and won't exist in the future. So, but let's get down to the points within it, because it could still be attempted. And what would be the effects of an open bordered world? Well, I agree that certain economic figures could be improved, but who are the people that really would benefit from such economic movement? We're not abolishing the nation state by having open borders, so you still have national governments that will decide policy. So, national governments would compete and use this for their advantage, right? They would want to attract people in. For example, America would want to attract people in, and for lower skilled people to compete and put downward pressure on wages. To lower the costs for corporations to produce their goods. This is a race to the bottom style economy, which I don't think is desirable for what Bernie Sanders would say is the 99% of people. So while big corporations may profit from this model, I think it actually pits low-income communities against each other. Secondly, this idea that we're no different from each other. Well, I agree that in our sort of moral character, communities aren't necessarily different from each other, but cultures are different. And complete unchecked or sort of rapid mixtures of culture might not be pleasant for anyone involved. And I think the sort of slower changes we have, like we have in the UK, where how immigration's worked in here over decades, where there's a gradual but significant amounts of people coming from different cultures from around the world, really works. And multiculturalism, I think, is a big success in the UK. But if you have open borders where thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people from one community seeking an economic opportunity can come and sort of just pile into one place, I think that is a recipe for disaster. Maybe not economically, but maybe the social fabric of a place, and people's respect for that culture, because we know that people are prone to prejudice. It's not an excuse for it, but at the same time, if you have this unchecked ability for people to come and completely change a place, the people who have lived in that place all that life, well, I think they deserve some say over how that place is shaped.
So I have some responses to that. First of all, I think your alarmist tone is perhaps misplaced. I don't think open borders would lead to a rampant flow of unchecked migration across the whole world. I think the ties that bind people to their homes are strong and is generally only very driven people who have a specific reason to leave their country who do so. Most people will stay where they are, even if they suddenly have the reason to do so. It's only people who are desperate or people who are extremely motivated to find a better world who will move. Secondly, you could talk about cultural disaster, and I say there's a coming humanitarian disaster. Climate change is going to cause millions of people around the world to be displaced. Bangladesh is one of the most densely populated countries in the world, which could all be below sea level in a few years as climate change increases. If we do not allow a huge increase in migration levels across the world, we are going to be talking about refugee camps across huge swathes of Asia. And I say that is a concern far greater than the concern you might raise about people in the UK worried about a rapidly changing culture.
Wouldn't you say a response to a humanitarian disaster like that is a concerted, cooperative effort amongst nations to take according to ability and need?
Yes.
That's not open borders, that's controlled migration.
Which sounds like the status quo, right? And the status quo is not working because...
Well, no, it's not.
Certain countries are choosing to take on far more of a responsibility than others. And, you know, Germany and Sweden are taking on far more migrants than any other countries in Europe.
Yeah, but it's more realistic to have a consolidated sort of cooperative, or even if not, well, we're coercing you into this policy than all countries having open borders.
Yeah. So if I'm taking off my hard libertarian hat for a second that I put on for the purposes of this show, I would say yes, that's probably a more realistic short-term and medium-term solution. But I still think it's worth. Your point about utopias is interesting because yes, you know, utopia is unachievable, but I don't think that means that we shouldn't have an idea in mind of where we would like to end up in an ideal society. And I don't think it's wrong to strive for a utopia, even if it's ultimately unattainable. We should plot a trajectory towards utopia, even if it's always just beyond the horizon.
It's a poetic way of putting it, but I don't think it's necessarily the most practical. I mean, why can't you just aim for a practical, nice, compassionate, good thing?
You can.
Without being unrealistic about it.
You can, of course. And I'm not calling for unrealistic action in the short term.
You're arguing for open borders,
right? No, I'm calling for unrealistic action in the long term. I'm saying that in the very long term, we should aim high. I think that's idealism in the long term is there have been countless cases in history where people have said that the idealistic option is unattainable, and then people have tried it and it has actually worked. So by ruling things out because you're saying they're unrealistic, you run the risk of not being able to attain truly, truly amazing things sometimes.
I see your point. It doesn't feel that specific to Open borders, though.
No, it's
I think open borders. Even if they are realistic or achievable, I think there's still a number of things that are undesirable, which I've stated.
Yeah. So your point about the depressing certain wages is interesting because if we were having this conversation 10 years ago, economists would be saying, no, this is wrong, this is incorrect. People don't understand their own economic conditions. Free movement of people and free movement of capital makes life better for everybody. And now I think economists would be more prone to acknowledge that, yes, it might give an overall boost to the economy, but in certain sectors and in certain places, it might depress wages for some people. And the reason why free trade agreements and stuff like that have become more unpopular is because the negative effects of these agreements are concentrated in certain areas, whereas the benefits are diffused across whole populations, for example. But then sort of the left-wing case would be, well, we've never tried to properly redistribute the benefits of these agreements. So if we did that, then open borders would be fine. The problem is that we've had free movement of people, had free movement of capital, but haven't taken steps to address the fact that there will be negative effects, but they'll be highly specific to some people. So if you just help those people.
Oh, we just have to sort out economic inequality as well. no problem then. There's also another issue of brain drain, which is already an issue in the world of developing nations that have low wages.
And I say that's false, because studies show that people moving from extremely poor countries to extremely rich countries generally make... if a Yemeni worker moves to the United States, they will generally, I can't remember if it was 12 or 15 times, they'll make a wage 12 or 15 times the wage that they would have earned back at home, which is such a huge increase that they can earn a good wage in the US and still afford to send huge amounts of money by Yemeni standards back to Yemen. So workers leaving Yemen for the United States is actually good for the Yemeni economy money is flowing from the US into Yemen.
But you're making your capitalist fallacy again, because not everything is about money.
I am.
Not everything's about money. I'm talking about necessary professionals that you need within a country. Mm-hmm. Doctors, for example. Lots of doctors, particularly, for example, Kenya, they have very good education and medical education there. But so many doctors from Kenya go straight to Britain for the economic opportunity because they can. But that leaves the people of Kenya in a pretty bad spot, medically speaking. Open borders would just exacerbate that problem.
Well, who can say?
And on that bombshell,
listener, you decide who won the argument.
So, after that excellent debate that I clearly won, we're going to bring you some lighter news to end the show. So, Alex, I hear I'm in search for a job. Are there any good jobs going at the moment?
Aren't we all? Yes. Tate Britain, not sponsors of the show, are advertising for a £40,000 a year head of coffee. Sounds good, right?
Yeah. I'm applying. It sounds quite full on, because
it does.
I mean, you're responsible for all aspects of coffee,
and there are many
within.
Let's be real.
The four Tate galleries. So really, there's a lot. There's big chain.
Yeah.
Four cafes, and you have to source, blend, and roast coffee for use in all of them. So you're getting paid $10,000 per cafe.
Yeah.
Just for
and there's multiple cafes in each museum. Let's be clear.
The more cultured man over there.
Yeah. Obviously never been to a art museum in his life.
And on that bombshell.
It's time to move on to Bolivian glass frogs. There's a glass frog which has been sighted in Bolivia for the first time in 15 years. So frog experts around the world are very excited, as I'm sure you are also.
Are they jumping for joy?
Indeed. Green with
envy. Why is this frog special?
So it's a translucent frog, which I guess makes it hard to spot. So that's maybe why they haven't seen it for so long.
Yes.
Very introverted animal.
Do you think there's just some random guy just sat in a bush for the last 20 years?
Friendless. Just wants to make his foggy pals. Yeah. I think there's quite a lot of jungle in Bolivia, so probably hard to find that fog.
Cool. Well, we've managed to make that lighthearted story quite somber. So I guess we'll sign off here.
Yeah.
This was our first try, so excuse us for the rustiness.
Bye-bye.
We'll see you, or you'll hear us next week.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Bye.